Serve It Cold, episode 17. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios.
Hello? Is this the Catherine Police tip line? Is that Mabel? Hey there, sugar. How you been? I ain't talked to you in a coon's age. I bet you're real glad those boys of yours are back in school and somebody else has to watch after them. Oh, it's Helen. I don't have to give you my name? You mean just anybody can call and talk to the police? Well, I declare. How you know they's telling the truth if they don't tell you who they is? Well, suit yourselves. I'm just calling in to report something mighty suspicious. Yep, that's right. Okay, you ready? So that Johnny Speed fellow what manages the Mini Mart in Crosstown and runs a private detecting business on the side? So I heard some university professor hired him to go down to the French Quarter on some mysterious assignment. I bet he's all tied up with that fellow got himself shot out by the lake. Oh, right. Well, he's back from New Orleans as of this afternoon. Johnny Speed, he drove right up and parked his van at Seely Jackson's house like it was his common practice. Well, I'm getting to that part, aren't I? So anyway, Johnny finally goes over to the Mini Mart, but he wasn't there to work. Him and Gojo, what works afternoons there, disappeared into the back for a long time. Well, I'd seen it with my own eyes when I was in getting some cough drops for church. So a long while later, they come out of the back office there and meet up with that Cajun fellow that came to town with Goat Johnson. I don't like his looks. Anyways, they all make some kind of pact to meet up and do some planning. All of them together. Well, doesn't that sound suspicious to you? I am not wasting the police's time. Okay, what about this? That cradle bar ain't open yet now, is it? And you know it's got no license to serve. So, why are there 8 cars parked out front when the place has no door and no lights on? I bet they all broke in and they're plotting in secret. Y'all ought to send somebody to check that out.
My cell phone rang. While the others carried on, I answered and heard Butch Ellis's voice.
You damn egghead. You don't need no null hypothesis and you don't need no touchy-feely action plan. What you need is a damn motive. And I think Gojo is right. You really do need to find out who killed Landis Grantham.
Oh, shit.
Well said, Speedy. Would you mind asking Mr. Johnson if it would be okay for me to come up? I've always wanted to meet the man.
Come on up, Butch. It took a few seconds for the babble of crosstalk to die in the room. I looked up to Vera, who held up the whiteboard eraser in an unspoken question. I shook my head no. Too late for that. This particular horse was out of the barn and over the hill. An interminable and silent wait followed. I found that I couldn't think about anything other than my inability to think. There was also a physical sensation, an overwhelming feeling of dread sliding up my back. It occurred to me that I might be having a heart attack, but quickly decided that I couldn't be that lucky. Then and there, I could hear Big John Turner's voice as clear as day saying, "Rule number one, Creedmoor, is make a plan and stick to it. Rule number two is don't ever marry a plan. When it starts to stink, flush it. And rule number three is don't try to impress yourself with your own cleverness while you're planning." "Now you tell me," Gojo turned to me and asked,
"What'd you say, JC?"
"Oh, nothing. Just another acid flashback. But remember, Gojo, rule number three is don't think out loud when the cops are listening." I turned to Lurker, but before I could say anything, Butch walked into the open door. He was dressed in jeans and a Mississippi Public Radio Beethoven t-shirt. I introduced him to Goat, Narlene, Sonny, and Lurker. He was just as gracious as a southern gentleman could be, which did nothing for the chain of knots crawling up my back. I asked him to have a seat, and he surprised me by doing just that, sitting opposite the whiteboard. Vera sat back down, too.
Speedy, you're absolutely right. We policemen can and do lie in our pursuit of justice, and we're champions at withholding information. But I'm sure you've got some questions to ask me right now. Ask away.
Were you listening on a legal wiretap?
Good question. I'm familiar with Mr. Winsong's reputation, so I assume he's swept the place for active transmitters. But passive listening devices are virtually undetectable except by exhaustive manual search. And you guys provided me with a great passive device.
He rose and walked over to the dumbwaiter.
I bet it can get hot up here without ventilation. I see you uncovered the dumbwaiter.
He slid the dumbwaiter door shut, and I understood. It was the Royal Street apartment acoustics all over again. You listened to us through the shaft.
That's right. I would have knocked before I came in, but there doesn't seem to be a door. I saw the cars parked outside and decided I should come on in and make sure the building was secure. Next thing I know, I started hearing voices. And surprise of surprises, the voices were talking about me.
Butch, where's Eaton?
Oh, Eaton's at home with his family. I'm off duty. Of course, as a sworn officer of the law, I'm never really off duty.
Okay, Butch. You just wandered in and heard voices. How did you know where the dumbwaiter shaft was?
Well, I didn't, but I did know that there was one. Speedy, you're big on stories. There's a great ghost story about this place, and it centers around this shaft. In 1954, my father was a rookie on the Catherine Police Squad. This was a gambling house in those days. You know how things were then. The place got raided every once in a while. The owners would pay some fines, maybe a bribe or two. Everything would be back up and running the next night. Well, Catherine had managed to produce a real bad character by the name of Skinny Haney. I can't remember what his real name was, but this Skinny had a real temper, had managed to kill people in 3 states, mostly his own friends. So someone tipped the department off that Skinny had come back home and was holed up here. They raided the place, 2 o'clock one Sunday morning. The guys downstairs shouted up the shaft as soon as the police come in the door, and everybody started stashing money away. Skinny decides he's got to hide, and jumps into the shaft and slides down the rope. Well, this is one of the few buildings in Catherine that has a cellar, and the shaft runs all the way down to it, and that's where Skinny Haney ends up, in the cellar. He's sitting pretty until somebody sends the dumbwaiter down to the cellar, too. It didn't squish Skinny, which would have saved the state a bucket load of money, but it did block him in where he couldn't climb back up. So everybody gets hauled downtown where they all, to a man, rat out Skinny. But nobody noticed him shimmying down the shaft, and he's nowhere to be found. By 4 o'clock, everybody, cops and hoodlums, have gone home to catch some sleep before church. In those days, even the illegal bars were closed on Sunday, so Skinny spends the whole day trapped in the shaft. Sunday night, Dad and the other rookie on the force pull stakeout duty on the slim hunch that Skinny might try to sneak back into the club. It's Halloween night, and all of Crosstown has got little goblins and skeletons and ghosts wandering all over the place. You got your older kids rolling yards and soaping windows, and you've got not a few grown-ups who are acting worse than the kids, just like Halloween is today in Catherine. Plus, since it's a Sunday, all the churches are having parties and sings and the like. The whole neighborhood is alive and on the street. But when things start to quiet down, my father starts hearing it. A sound coming from inside the building. Knocking at a high, raspy sound like nothing he's ever heard before. Of course, what he was hearing was what was left of Skinny Haney's voice. He said he and the other guy were shaken so they couldn't keep their flashlight beams steady, but they were even more afraid of looking like rookie fools than they were of a ghost. Plus, they were half convinced that they were being hazed by some of the old-timers. It took them 2 more hours to find him, and when they did, he wasn't much more than a pile of sweat and nerves. Even after they got him cleaned up, he couldn't or wouldn't talk. He'd just curl up in the nearest corner and hiss like a cat. But it turns out that jumping down this shaft saved old Skinny from the chair. They shipped him off to the state mental hospital in Whitfield. Before they could certify him eligible to stand trial, he got thrown through a 3rd-story window by a fellow patient who apparently didn't like the way he hissed. This time around, Skinny didn't survive the plunge.
Wow, Butch. What a heartwarming story.
Why, thank you, ma'am. Now let's get down to solving this murder, folks.
I raised a finger. Just wait a minute, Butch. I don't think we've finished with the 20 questions thing yet.
Speedy, do you need 20 questions? Aren't you supposed to be the private detective here?
Yes, I am. I'm the particular private detective that your police department goes out of its way to harass and discredit. So my next question is, why on earth are you sitting here in civvies with this motley crew instead of out with Eaton Barton working on the physical evidence in this case? Butch blanched a bit, and the cockiness left his face. He looked around the room.
Okay, guys. I'd rather have had this talk in private with Speedy, but here goes. It's been well established that you can't trust me to keep any secrets that have bearing on this or any other case, but I'm going to ask you to keep a couple of secrets that deal with departmental politics.
He stopped talking, his face falling even more. You could tell he was already regretting voicing even the hint of dissension. As usual, Vera came to the rescue.
Butch, I think you can trust us to keep your confidence. Police department politics hardly ever comes up in conversation down at my mini-mart, and I don't think that consorting with known police officers will gain any of us any points on the street around here. Here, we've got two of Letha's beef ribs left. Here's a Diet Coke. Johnny won't let anybody drink a beer until we get through with this meeting. Lord knows, some of us need one.
Butch thanked Vera and took a bite from a rib.
Oh, that's good. I didn't even know I was hungry. Okay, here's the deal. The department is going through growing pains. No great secret there. Now, I think the new chief is great, but he doesn't always get the best advice from his higher-level officers. Bottom line is that Eaton and I are being punished because of some hard feelings left over from the last administration. See, Eaton was the one who researched the neighborhood team program, wrote the application, and won the grant with zero support from the department. Some people are still mad about that, and they have shown themselves to be clever enough to use it against us. So, because Eaton and I are the crosstown team leaders, we're being frozen out of the Grantham investigation. They say it happened out of our territory. Now, we are the two most experienced and qualified investigators on the force.
Shouldn't homicide investigate this? No, I expect you don't have a homicide unit in Catherine. But don't you have detectives?
Yes, we do. Eaton and I both carry the rank of detective. But we are very short on manpower and budget, and Catherine is growing in leaps and bounds. We're doing everything we can just to get bodies on the street, and truly, we don't have great need for a dedicated detective force. Catherine sure has more than its share of murders, but in these parts, the person still stabbing the body when the first officer arrives is usually the culprit.
So, Butch, they don't want you playing Columbo. Why don't you just let them walk out on that limb and either solve the case or have to come ask for your help? Vera answered the question.
It's Eaton. Eaton's blaming himself for you two being frozen out and is sitting at home moping. You've probably already had a fight about the whole thing, and now you're out trying to do something to make things better.
Officer Ellis sat silent, his face reddening. Goat gave a long, low whistle.
Vera, ma'am, please remind me to never play poker with you.
Yes, my wife. Mind reader to the stars. Butch found his voice.
Okay, you're right, Vera, but that's only part of it. You see, this is the real deal. A premeditated, well-planned, coolly executed murder. Time's passing. It's been almost a full day now, and the only leads that I know about run straight through this room. Now, from what I've heard already, Speedy, you think you're being set up for something.
Okay, Butch. Before I start spilling my guts, I need to confer with my co-conspirators for a minute.
Do you want me to go stand in the hall like in the fourth grade Halloween King elections?
No, Butch. I always figured that you were eavesdropping even back then. You might as well stay and save the strain on your ears. Guys, those of you who haven't had to put up with Butch for several decades, this is what I can tell you about him. Butch Ellis is cantankerous, bullheaded, is generally a company man, and has a tendency to be judgmental. And those are his good qualities. He was born tough. I should know, we've butted heads literally all our lives. You know that his father was a cop. Well, his grandfather and great-grandfather were both sheriffs who spent their lives fighting the meanest knotheads to ever crawl from the South Mississippi swamps. If you cut him, he will bleed police blue. That said, Butch is smarter than his superiors would like him to be. He's as honest as his job allows him to be, and has never, ever been a bully, on the job or off. Importantly for this state, town, and room, Butch carries around fewer prejudices than anyone I know. Although he does seem to have a problem with 350-pound guys with beards. But the most important thing is that the man likes my coffee. I polled the room silently, checking agreement in the eyes of Vera, Gojo, Narlene, and Goat. Sonny was cautious, but gave a why-not shrug. Lurker, of course, wouldn't look me in the eyes. Good. Butch, you're in the club. Your secret decoder ring will arrive in the mail in approximately 6 weeks. We'll show you the secret handshake later, and as usual, new guy brings the barbecue to the next meeting. Okay. I'm about to tell you the story as we know it from start to finish. Please don't try to mentally add up misdemeanors and felonies in your head as I talk, and please don't ask for clarification about said misdemeanors and felonies, as they might pertain to the assembled good guys. Now, all of you assembled good guys, let me tell the story. Don't jump in with corrections, additions, or opinions, especially considering any possible misdemeanors and felonies. We don't want to confuse Officer Ellis here. Got it? So I told the story one more time, even more carefully this time, but I tried not to hide any pertinent facts. Butch pulled a pad and pen from his back pocket and took notes. I saw that Vera and Gojo were doing the same. As I talked, I could see things more clearly this time around, and I could feel myself starting to relax again. When I finished, there was a long silence as we all watched Butch continue to scribble in his little notebook. Finally, he stopped writing and sat back in his chair.
Well, Speedy, you really stepped off into a deep hole this time. This is a real nest of hooks, even for you.
Thanks for the professional assessment, Butch. I appreciate it.
Don't mention it. Okay, I gather that you don't believe it was really Landis Grantham that hired you. You think you were hired by whom? Latimer Grantham and Lily Grantham, right? Hired to provide them with alibis for Landis's murder. Okay, I can see that, but then you think that this Ray Ragonet is the trigger guy. And the evidence that connects Ragonet with the murder is the fact that Latimer and Lily smoke the same kind of pot that he sells? Speedy, I don't want to seem overly critical, but I think that you must be smoking too much of the same shit. That's just a little bit paranoid, even for you.
But Ray was back in Catherine when the murder took place.
Well, maybe, Miss Moore, but we really don't know that Ragonet came back to Catherine at all. And if he actually was in Catherine, that would only put him in the company of 40,000 other souls who are in town Tuesday night. Now, I'm not saying Ragonet is not a bad guy who needs to be taken off the street, but I'm not ready to tie him into the Landis murder just because Jonathan Speed happens to be working on two cases involving pot smokers.
Narlene started to open her mouth again, but I stilled her with a small shake of my head. Butch, I realize we don't have any evidence, just some theories, but I know that somebody is trying to play me here. Has any of this helped you?
Oh, sure. Theories are good, and yours are as good as anyone's so far. It sure sounds like Ragonet is just the type who would think it'd be an easy payday to waltz into Little Catherine, Mississippi, and pop some professor. I certainly would like to talk to the guy. The most important thing for me is that you've answered a lot of questions I had about what was happening with you and the phone calls the last couple of days. But like I said to start with, what we really need on the Grantham case is a motive. Did the brother and the wife pay for a hit? Sounds like a good possibility, but why? They were already separated. Latimer and Lily don't seem to be hiding their relationship. Money? I've done some very preliminary poking around, but it seems like Latimer is not hurting financially, and Lily could have expected half the assets of the marriage without killing the poor guy. Speedy, we've got the how. We find out why Landis Grantham was killed, and the who will slide right in like the last piece of a jigsaw puzzle.
As my mantel clock chimed two times later that night, I still wasn't any closer to finding that missing puzzle piece. From the bedroom adjoining the study, I could hear assorted sleep sounds coming from Vera and the pile of dogs pinning her to the bed. I tried to lie down twice, but it seemed like I was too tired to sleep. This time around, I numbed my brain with downloading my pictures of Cindy Altman's art show and polishing them a bit in Photoshop. I found it interesting that the 40 were easier to recognize on the confines of my computer screen than they had been hanging on the gallery walls. I also realized that they were all posed doing everyday things that people just normally don't do in the nude. Jimmy Taylor, the driving force behind the Catherine Community Theater Guild, had his hand drawn back behind his head, muscles taut as if he were hammering away at a scene backdrop. Tam Beckett, the subdued beauty who ran Catherine's only vegetarian cafe and herb shop, was shown on one knee, facing away from the viewer but caught in the act of turning back, hand starting to rise in greeting. One shadow-drawn bunch of garlic chives in bloom placed the sweat-streaked figure in a garden and not a boudoir. It carried innocence and fecund ripeness. This drawing had the power of a Theodore Rothke poem. And there was Judge Joe Harless himself, the man who once told me that I was emblematic of all that is wrong with America. He was sitting back, bandy legs splayed, his head twisted to the side in a way familiar to anyone who had the doubtful opportunity to stand before his bench as he carried on his interminable consultations with his clerk. The drawing was of a younger Harless, but Cindy had nailed him right down to that one beady eye constantly watching the defendant. But the judge was not my favorite. When I did open my favorite, I was shocked right back to wakefulness. Shocked at the beauty, the artistry, and shocked that I hadn't recognized the subject, because there, standing in front of me, her face half obscured by her right arm as she stood on tiptoe to pluck a carton of cigarettes from the overhead rack, was Vera. She was beautiful. Her full breasts thrust right into the viewer's face made my mouth water. I made a copy and sent it to her power book over the LAN. I then slid it into the rotation folder for her desktop background. No use hogging all the shock to myself. I took another look at those hyper-realistic breasts and wondered what my chances were of waking Vera and straining her out of the pack of dogs at 2 o'clock in the morning. I knew that those chances were slim, but what the hell? As Annie would say, sweet dreams are made of this. I powered down the computers.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where Is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at dancingcatstudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at patiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com, or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like, with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at dancingcatstudios.com.